You're listening to WDCE 90.1 FM and streaming online, WDCE.org, University of Richmond Radio. This is DJ Strider, and you're at the top of the Strange Cucumber Show. And the number at the station is 804-289-8790, and you can email me at striderlee@gmail.com. That's striderlee@gmail.com. Or you can send me a tweet to Strider Lee, or let's see, what else could there be? Here's, yeah, well, that should be it. That's good enough. So several ways to contact me, and I encourage audio submissions. I've got a lot of interesting stuff. I have some new stuff from Sidestep Complex tonight and a few other things. So stick with me. Was Ima Sumac from her album Ivaro. And the next couple of pieces are going to be from a local band. This is actually an old recording when these guys were all high school students. I'm pretty sure they're still playing in town. I'm going to look them up online right now, but enjoy these very skillful and pretty hopping licks from a band called Think. Thank you. Okay, that was local band Think, and you can find them online. It looks like I might have lost it. They have a MySpace page, but if you just type in Richmond, Virginia and Think, you'll see some of their tour dates. They also have a Reverb Nation page. So check them out. Definitely some good sound. We'll be playing a little bit more of them later in the show. You're listening to WDCE 90.1 FM and streaming online, WDCE.org, University of Richmond Radio.
His job is to help protect us when there is danger of the atomic bomb. It will be much safer. We are ready. It will be much safer. We are ready. It will be much safer. We must all get ready now.
For centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it. And eventually, they'll go insane. And eventually, they'll go insane. They'll go insane. And eventually,
shapes inside.
Oh, I see them everywhere.
What else?
It has kind of wedge shapes inside.
Yellow, black.
Black and yellow.
And with
rectangular
wedge shapes inside.
Oh, I see them everywhere. Do you hear me?
There. Just lie back.
Black and
Yellow with
everywhere. Do you hear me?
There, Mrs. Black.
Well, wedge shapes.
Mrs. Wedge.
Everywhere.
There. Back on the couch.
What does it mean?
Rectangular, black, and with wedge shapes inside.
Oh, I see them everywhere. Everywhere.
Just lie back on the couch.
What does it mean?
Yellow and with black shapes.
Wedge shapes inside.
Inside.
Oh, everywhere. Do you hear me?
There. Back on the couch.
What does it mean?
Mrs. Yellow, back on the couch.
What does it mean? Am I losing my mind?
Just lie back on the couch.
What does it mean?
Just lie back.
Am I losing my mind?
There.
Everywhere.
Just lie back.
Do you hear me?
There, Mrs.
Everywhere. Do you hear me?
There.
Do you hear me?
Mrs.
Rectangular.
Mrs. Rectangular, yes.
Am I losing my mind?
What you have been seeing everywhere you look are those yellow and black signs used to indicate a fallout shelter in buildings.
Uh-huh. So you see these signs too, Dr. Black?
Why, sure, Mrs. Rectangular.
Oh, well, I feel better already.
Couple of pieces from Negative Land. Their album, Escape from Noise. And now, a few words of wisdom from the great English thinker Aldous Huxley. No, that's not Aldous.
The deterioration since Greek times is indicative of the fact that we have conversation with drinking parties on the side. They will come along in due course. The Protestant ethic does not permit a drinking party at this hour. Now, it is highly appropriate that we should open this discussion of the impact of science and technology on democratic institutions by presenting the man who first saw it all, the brave new world, the brave new world revisited. Mr. Huxley has indicated the problems that we are now going to discuss. All of my generation were brought up on Chrome Yellow and Andy Kay, written by a brilliant young esthete in England, who, since that time, has retained the brilliance of his style and penetration, but has moved on even more interesting subjects than those with which he dealt in the carefree 20s. Mr. Huxley is a constant attendant, I'm happy to say, at our discussions in Santa Barbara, and now that we're beginning, the most important one we ever had, I'm glad to have him here to introduce him. Mr. Huxley.
May I remain sitting? Because it's I'm going to have to read with a glass.
If you can sit loud, you can remain.
All right, I can sit loud. I'll try and sit loud, because I have difficulty in reading. This is the title of this thing is Democratic Institutions in the Context of Advancing Science and Technology. Sort of general introduction to this subject. In politics, the central and fundamental problem is the problem of power. Who is to exercise power, and by what authority, with what purpose in view, and under what controls? Yes, under what controls? For as history has made it abundantly clear, to possess power is ipso facto to be tempted to abuse it. In mere self-preservation, we must create and maintain institutions that make it difficult for the powerful to be led into those temptations which, when succumbed to, transform them into tyrants at home and imperialists abroad. For this purpose, what kind of institutions are effective, and having created them, how can we guarantee them against obsolescence? Circumstances change. And as they change, the old, the once so admirably effective devices for controlling power, cease to be adequate. What then? Specifically, when advancing science and acceleratingly progressive technology alter man's long-standing relationships with the planet on which he lives, revolutionize his societies, and at the same time equip his rulers with new and immensely more powerful instruments of domination, what ought we to do? What can we do? Very briefly, let us review the situation in which we now find ourselves, and in the light of present facts, hazard a few guesses about the future. On the biological level, advancing science and technology have set going a revolutionary process that seems to be destined for the next century at least, perhaps for much longer, to exercise a decisive influence upon the destinies of all societies and their individual members. In the course of the last 50 years, extremely effective methods for lowering the prevailing rates of infant and adult mortality were developed by Western scientists. These methods were very simple and could be applied with the expenditure of very little money by very small numbers of not very highly trained technicians. For these reasons, and because everyone regards life as intrinsically good and death as intrinsically bad, they were in fact applied on a worldwide scale. The results were spectacular. In the past, high birth rates were balanced by high death rates. Thanks to science, death rates have been halved, but except in the most highly industrialized, contraceptive-using countries, birth rates remain as high as ever. An enormous and accelerating increase in human numbers has been the inevitable consequence. At the beginning of the Christian era, so demographers assure us, our planet supported a human population of about 250 million. When the Pilgrim Fathers stepped ashore, the figure had risen to about 500 million. We see then that in the relatively recent past, it took 1,600 years for the human species to double its numbers. Today, world population stands at 3,000 million. By the year 2000, unless something appallingly bad or miraculously good should happen in the interval, 6,000 million of us will be sitting down to breakfast every morning. In a word, 12 times as many people are destined to double their numbers in 1/40th of the time. And this is not the whole story. In many areas of the world, human numbers are increasing at a rate much higher than the average for the whole species. In India, for example, the rate of increase is now 2.3% per annum. By 1990, its 450 million inhabitants will have become 900 million inhabitants. A comparable rate of increase will raise the population of China to the billion mark by about 1980. In Ceylon, in Egypt, in many of the countries of South and Central America, human numbers are increasing at an annual rate of 3%. The result will be a doubling of their present populations in approximately 23 years. On the social, political, and economic levels, what is likely to happen in an underdeveloped country whose population doubles itself in a single generation or even less? An underdeveloped society is a society without adequate capital resources. For capital is what is left over after primary needs have been satisfied, and in underdeveloped countries, most people never satisfy their primary needs. It is also a society without a sufficient force of trained teachers, administrators, and technicians, a society with few or no industries and few or no developed sources of industrial power, a society, finally, with enormous arrears in food production, education, road building, housing, and sanitation to be made good. A quarter of a century from now, when there will be twice as many of them as there are today, what is the likelihood that the members of such a society will be better fed, better housed, clothed, and schooled than at present? And what are the chances in such a society for the maintenance, if they already exist, or the creation, if they do not exist, of democratic institutions? Not long ago, Mr. Eugene Black, the president of the World Bank, expressed the opinion that it would be extremely difficult, perhaps even impossible, for an underdeveloped country with a very rapid rate of population increase to achieve full industrialization. All its resources, he pointed out, would be absorbed year by year in the task of supplying, or not quite supplying, the primary needs of its new members. Merely to stand still, merely to maintain its current subhumanly inadequate standard of living, will require hard work and the expenditure of all the nation's available capital. Available capital may be increased by loans and gifts from abroad, but in a world where the industrialized nations are involved in a power politics and an increasingly expensive armament race, there will never be enough foreign aid to make much difference, And even if the loans and gifts to underdeveloped countries were to be substantially increased, any resulting gains would be largely nullified by the uncontrolled population explosion. If Mr. Black is correct, and there are plenty of economists and demographers who share his opinion, the outlook for most of the world's newly independent and economically non-viable nations is gloomy indeed. To those that have shall be given. Within the next 10 or 20 years, if war can be avoided, poverty will almost have disappeared from the highly industrialized and contraceptive-using societies of the West. Meanwhile, in the underdeveloped and uncontrolledly breeding societies of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the condition of the masses, twice as numerous a generation from now as they are today, will have become no better and may even be decidedly worse than it is at present. Such a decline is foreshadowed by current statistics of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. In some underdeveloped regions of the world, we are told, people are somewhat less adequately fed, clothed, and housed than where their parents and grandparents 30 and 40 years ago. And what of elementary education? UNESCO recently provided an answer. Since the end of World War II, heroic efforts have been made to teach the whole world how to read. The population explosion has largely stultified these efforts. The absolute number of illiterates is greater now than at any time in the past. The contraceptive revolution, which, thanks to advancing science and technology, has made it possible for the highly developed societies of the West to offset the consequences of birth control by a planned control of births, has had as yet no effect upon the family life of people in underdeveloped countries. This is not surprising. Death control, as I have already remarked, is easy, cheap, and can be carried out by a small force of technicians. Birth control, on the other hand, is rather expensive, involves the whole adult population, and demands of those who practice it a good deal of forethought and directed willpower. To persuade hundreds of millions of men and women to abandon their tradition-hallowed views of sexual morality, then to distribute and teach them to make use of contraceptive devices or fertility-controlling drugs, this is a huge and difficult task. So huge and so difficult that it seems very unlikely that it can be successfully carried out within a sufficiently short space of time in any of the countries where control of birth rate is most urgently needed. Extreme poverty, when combined with ignorance, breeds that lack of desire for better things which has been called wantlessness, the resigned acceptance of a subhuman lot. But extreme poverty, when it is combined with the knowledge that some societies are affluent, breeds envious desires and the expectation that these desires must of necessity and very soon be satisfied. By means of the mass media, those easily exportable products of advancing science and technology, some knowledge of what life is like in affluent societies has been widely disseminated among the world's underdeveloped regions. But alas, the science and technology which have given the industrial West its cars, refrigerators, and contraceptives have given the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America only movies and radio broadcasts, which they are too simple-minded to be able to criticize, together with a population explosion which they are still too poor and too tradition-bound to be able to control by deliberate family planning. In the context of a 3% or even of a mere 2% annual increase in numbers, high expectations are foredoomed to disappointment. From disappointment through resentful frustration to widespread social unrest, the road is short. Shorter still is the road from social unrest through chaos to dictatorship, possibly of the Communist Party, more probably of generals and colonels. It would seem then that for two-thirds of the human race, and the two-thirds of the human race now suffering from the consequences of uncontrolled breeding in a context of industrial backwardness, poverty and illiteracy, the prospects for democracy during the next 10 or 20 years are poor in the extreme. From underdeveloped societies and the probable political consequences of their explosive increase in numbers, we now pass to the prospects for democracy in the fully industrialized, contraceptive-using societies of the West. It used to be assumed that political freedom was a necessary precondition of scientific research. Ideological dogmatism and dictatorial institutions were supposed to be incompatible with the open-mindedness and the freedom of experimental action, in the absence of which discovery and invention are impossible. Recent history has proved these comforting assumptions to be completely unfounded. It was under Stalin that Russian scientists developed the A-bomb and a few years later the H-bomb. And it is under a more than Stalinist dictatorship that Chinese scientists are now in process of performing the same feat. Another disquieting lesson of recent history is that in a developing society, science and technology can be used exclusively for the enhancement of military power, not at all for the benefit of the masses. Russia has demonstrated, and China is now doing its best to demonstrate, that poverty and primitive conditions of life for the overwhelming majority of the population are perfectly compatible with the wholesale production of the most advanced and sophisticated military hardware. Indeed, it is by deliberately imposing poverty on the masses that the rulers of developing industrial nations are able to create the capital necessary for building an armament industry and maintaining a well-equipped army with which to play their part in the suicidal game of international power politics. We see then that democratic institutions and libertarian traditions are not at all necessary to the progress of science and technology, and that such progress does not of itself make for human betterment at home and peace abroad. Only where democratic institutions already exist, only where the masses can vote their rulers out of office and so compel them to pay some attention to the popular will, are science and technology used for the benefit of the majority as well as for increasing the power of the state. And even where democratic institutions exist, science, technology, and preparation for war combine to pose a serious threat to civil and political liberty. A few days before he left the White House.
Some words of wisdom from Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, a novel of increasing relevance, and a brilliant thinker, broad-minded and very experimental. That was called The Politics of Ecology. You can find the whole speech online and on my Facebook page. I've put a link to the text, and it was part of what's called the Psychedelic Salon. You're listening to DJ Strider and the Strange Cucumber Show on WDCE 90.1 FM and streaming online WDCE.org, University of Richmond Radio. In Richmond, it's cloudy, 58 degrees. Tomorrow, there's a 20% chance of thunderstorms. It should be a high of 81. Time now is 11:43.
Hello, special lady. I think it's time for a little one-on-one conversation. Talking about my baby, baby. Not you, baby. Our baby, baby. And recent scientific studies of lactation.
Baby, you gotta know the facts, lady.
Magical lady, gotta get down to business. Gonna turn the lights down real low for a slideshow. Childhood disease resistance. Wonderful woman, if you do breastfeed, a little baby will be at less risk for respiratory illnesses. Hey, I'm just talking about breastfeeding. Educate your sweet self at 800-994-WOMAN or 4woman.gov or talk to your healthcare provider. Babies were born to be breastfed exclusively for 6 months. This public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station, baby.
Friday, May 25th, 2012, 12:04 p.m.
And we have confirmation that the second stage capture is underway. This is Mission Control Houston at 11:02 a.m. Central, 12:02 p.m. Eastern Time. Second stage capture is complete. At a mission elapsed time for Dragon of 3 days, 8 hours, 18 minutes. The Dragon spacecraft now part of the International Space Station complex, the first ever commercial spacecraft to visit the International Space Station, and the first U.S. spacecraft to visit the ISS since Space Shuttle Atlantis last July.
SS RMS operator on Space to Ground 2, you have a go for SS RMS brakes on.
Is it? Putting the arm to safe mode. Are we safe? Brakes on.
And station Houston, Space Ground 2, we see the arm is safe and we're complete for robotics activities for the day. Good job. Thanks a lot from down here.
It was a great day for that. Let's continue with Dragon.
All right.
We'll and we all appreciate and how we all appreciate all the work that you guys on the ground, both in Houston and in at Hawthorne. It takes a heap of folks to make this happen, and we just happen to be up here, but all you folks working on the ground, we're all part of a big team. Thanks a lot for making this happen.
Okay, copy that, and this is Joe. You want me to go for the CBS camera uninstall?
And Joe, we're ready for you to uninstall the camera.
And now that the Dragon spacecraft is firmly attached to its berthing port on the Harmony module, the station's robotic arm has been reactivated and locked into place. It will remain attached to the grapple pin on the Dragon spacecraft. The crew's activities with the robotic arm are completed, and now Joe Acaba will move on to disassembling the centerline berthing camera system, the CBCS by its acronym, that essentially helped the crew with alignment before the Dragon was installed on the berthing port. So all the activities have gone very smoothly on the Orbit 2 shift under direction of Flight Director Courtney McMillan here in Houston in the International Space Station Flight Control Room, as well as out in Hawthorne, California. That team, overseen by Mission Director Marco Villa, has been working in close proximity to each other in terms of on the voice loops. Obviously, they're a coast away, but they are in continuous contact with one another to choreograph all of the day's activities associated with this historic day with the Dragon spacecraft arriving at the International Space Station just before 9 a.m. Central Time, the official grapple time of the Dragon to the station's robotic arm by astronaut Don Pettit was 8:56 a.m. Central, 9:56 this morning Eastern Time. And while all of those activities ran a couple of hours late, the end game was the success of the Dragon spacecraft, the first commercial cargo vehicle arrival at the International Space Station. Quite a bit of time was made up in the after the grapple, arriving at the point where the Dragon was berthed to the International Space Station, and that berthing officially designated as 1102 when stage two capture was completed with the bolt loading, 1102 a.m. Central, 1202 p.m. Eastern Time. At a Dragon mission elapsed time of 3 days, 8 hours, and 18 minutes. The next steps for the crew on board are to begin the actual vestibule leak check. That's a small area between the hatchways on the station side and on the Dragon side. The crew will perform leak checks to ensure a good seal between the two spacecraft before what's known as vestibule outfitting can begin, and that essentially is a point where the crew can essentially equalize the pressure between the vestibule, the hatches on the Dragon side and on the station side, to ensure an equal amount of pressure exists on both sides of the station hatchway on the Harmony module. And that will lead to additional work by the crew to begin installing dual cables. If they can only get to one today, that's fine, but it's essentially a power and data cable that has already been pre-positioned at the hatchway on the station side. That will be installed to provide power and data link between the station and Dragon. And then, obviously, the second cable is for redundancy. That can be done as well before the crew ends its work day this afternoon. But in any case, everything's gone very smoothly, and we do plan to hold a mission status briefing on all of today's activities and a look ahead at what's in store for hatch opening and ingress into the Dragon, scheduled for Saturday. That mission status briefing today is still scheduled for noon, a little less than an hour from now, about 45 minutes from now. There will be a phone bridge established for that, so be sure, news media, be sure to call the Johnson Space Center newsroom to be tied into that briefing if you cannot attend in person. The planned participants for today's mission status briefing are Holly Ridings, who was on the lead shift. She's the lead station flight director for this Dragon mission to the station. She has been on console, or was on console, throughout the night, and completed her shift at the point where Dragon was captured by the station's robotic arm. She'll be joined here in Houston by Space Station Program Manager Mike Suffredini. And then two additional participants that are out in Hawthorne, California, will also participate remotely and be tied into the press briefing as well. SpaceX Chief Executive Officer, CEO, and Chief Designer Elon Musk, along with NASA Commercial Orbital Transportation Services Program Manager Alan Lindenmoyer, they will be participating remotely from California.
Houston Station, go ahead. Yeah, just wanted to let you know, we think this bolt loading for us down here is going to take about an hour. And once that's complete, we'll call you up, and then we'll be ready to start up with the Dragon vestibule pressurization check across the interface.
I copy that. Thanks for the heads up. That'll give us all a chance to have a bit of a break before we start in on the vestibule.
Sounds good. Enjoy the break.
Torquing of the bolts, however, the official berthing time was 11:02 this morning Central Time, 12:02 p.m. Eastern Time. A Dragon now part of the International Space Station complex for the next week or so. That coming after an all-night activity of rendezvous and docking of the Dragon to the space station using the station's robotic arm. The activities went very smoothly. It was very methodical, of course, but it's a historic day for the space programs, both NASA and Space Exploration Technologies. The next steps will be for the crew to wait a little while until the final torquing on the bolts is completed. They'll do a pressure leak check between the two spacecraft, an area known as the vestibule, to ensure a good seal between the two spacecraft. And then they will proceed with vestibule outfitting to get the spacecraft ready for hatch opening and ingress, which is scheduled for Saturday. The plan now is we will conclude our coverage for the day and return at 4:30 in the morning Saturday, 5:30 a.m. Eastern Time for the hatch opening and ingress coverage. So be sure to tune in Saturday morning for all of that activity as well. But next up on NASA TV, of course, will be the mission status briefing I mentioned a little while ago, scheduled for noon Central, 1 o'clock this afternoon Eastern Time, to discuss all of the activities and the success of the arrival of Dragon to the International Space Station, and also a look ahead at all of tomorrow's activities. So again, a great day in space aboard the International Space Station with the arrival of Dragon. And next up, the mission status briefing. We'll be back again here tomorrow morning early at 4:30 a.m. Central, 5:30 Eastern, with continuing coverage of the Dragon spacecraft's voyage to the International Space Station. This is Mission Control, Houston.
Coffee kind of makes me nervous when I drink it.
I'm the first person, you're the second person. Earlier today I was in the third person. I'm the first person, you're the second person. Earlier today I was in the third person. I'm the first person, you're the second person. Earlier today I was in the third person. Stop cursing, start diversing. Edifices, bliss, the sunshine will pick your mind. Expand your thoughts, stretch it out, don't doubt. My mind, my brain is caught, I'm just blessed. Trip hopping, so I flow like a stream. It's just a dream.
Oh, don't know if I'm truly awake or if I'm still dreaming.
That was Dream, Forest for the Trees. You're listening to WDCE 90.1 FM and streaming online, WDCE.org, University of Richmond Radio. Number at the station is 804-289-8790, or you can email me at striderlee@gmail.com. That's striderlee @gmail.com. And now something in honor of the great Doc Watson.
Jimmy Driftwood wrote this thing. Hello there. 1, 2, 3.
Four, five, six.
Do we want to try a break? Now your fiddle break comes right after I get back and whoop her brother and her paw and sing a chorus.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
Yeah. Now, that is about as pretty a bass line as I've heard played in something in a long time. I compliment that boy back there. That's a horse's foot in the gravel, man. That ain't train. Running through a ford in the creek.
Want to try one, Doc?
Let's see if we can put down a take. Where's the harmony at? Right here?
Oh, he's talking to the bass player. Come on, Jimmy.
About 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ruddin' that Tennessee stud. I had some trouble with my sweetheart's paw, and one of her brothers was a bad outlaw. I sent her a letter by my Uncle Foot, then I rode away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. We drifted on down into no man's land, we crossed that river called the Rio Grande. I raced my horse with the Spaniard's foal till it got me a skin full of silver and gold. Me and the gambler, we couldn't agree. We got in a fight over Tennessee. We jerked our guns and he fell with a thud, and I got away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud. Well, I got just as lonesome as a man can be, a-dreamin' of my girl in Tennessee. The Tennessee stud's green eyes turned blue, 'cause he was a-dreamin' of a sweetheart too. We loped right back across Arkansas. I whooped her brother and I whooped her paw. When I found that girl with the golden hair, she was a-riding that Tennessee mare. Whoa, boy. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud.
Syrup to syrup and side by side, we crossed the mountains and the valleys wide. We came to Big Muddy, then we forded a flood on the Tennessee Mare and the Tennessee Stud. There's a pretty little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse coat playing around the door. I love that girl with the golden hair, and the Tennessee Stud loves the Tennessee Mare. There's good horses. The Tennessee Stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. And he had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee Stud.
That was bluegrass great Doc Watson, who passed away just a few days ago, May 29th. He was a blind guitar, banjo, and other instrument player who developed his own picking style and won a Lifetime Grammy Achievement Award, 7 Grammys, and a real serious influence in bluegrass music. And that's a song that you don't hear as often, so I thought it would be fun to share. That's from an album called Will the Circle Be Unbroken.